expand production and export of genuine Turkoman carpets.
Towering over this cultural landscape is perhaps Kurdistan's most recognizable landmark, Gumbad-e Kavus Tower. This 53-meter-high brick monument was built in 1006 AD for Qabus ibn Voshmgir, a Ziyarit ruler, scholar, and patron of the arts.
Standing near the ruins of ancient Jurjan, once a flourishing center of science and culture, this tower is all that survived the Mongol invasions of the 14th and 15th centuries. Its tapering cylindrical form and striking conical roof make it a masterpiece of early Islamic architecture, influencing structures across Iran, Anatolia, and Central Asia. Mr. Arozjon Shomali, Vice President of the Golestan Province Chamber of Commerce.
We're now in Gumbad-e Kavus, a city whose thousand-year-old tower, near Gumbad, tells the story of a very ancient and proud history. This monument was built around the early 11th century by Shamsul Mali Qabus ibn Voshki. He was a ruler known for his love of knowledge and learning, and he brought many scholars of his time here, turning this area into an important center of culture and science.
Mr. Shomali said that the cultural interconnection between Golestan and Central Asia has provided the province with a unique opportunity.
Our region has very deep historic ties with Central Asia. Just across the border, the first ancient city is Nesar. Then you reach Marv and further on Bukhara, Samarkand and Tashkent in Uzbekistan. On the other side, towards Tajikistan, you have Dushanbe. Culturally, we're very close and connected. That's why there's huge potential for tourism. Travel agencies on the other side can promote tours to this region and bring visitors here. Through my work with the Chamber of Commerce and my trips there, I can clearly see the interest. They genuinely want to come and experience our country up close.
Kurdistan's economy primarily thrives on agriculture. The province plays a crucial role in Iran's food security, producing wheat, oilseeds, rice, and orchard crops. It ranks among the top producers of wheat and oilseeds nationwide, alongside major contributions in fruit, poultry, shrimp, and caviar.
Mr. Haman Hashemi, Vice President of the Agriculture Commission of the Iran Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture.
Golestan's economy is heavily dependent on agriculture. The share of agriculture in the province's GDP is almost twice the national average, and the same is true for employment in this sector. We also have a very high rural production compared to most other provinces, again, close to double the national average. In fact, the number of people living in villages is almost on par with our urban population, which makes Golestan one of the most rural-based provinces in the country.
With improved processing industries, Golestan could transform into a dominant exporter of agricultural goods. It contains more than 451,000 hectares of forest, 868,205 hectares of rangeland, and about 712,000 hectares of farmland. Seven distinct climate zones allow for an astonishing variety of crops. Field crops rankings. First in soybean, sunflower, rapeseed, tobacco. Third in wheat. Fourth in rice and cotton. Eighth in sugar beet. Ninth in sesame. Orchard crops rankings. First in persimmon, greenhouse pineapple, pecan. Second in nigella, greenhouse lemon. Third in peach, strawberry, kiwi. Fourth in borage. Fifth in plum, orange. Sixth in olive. Livestock and poultry rankings. Second in chicken meat. Fourth in silk cocoons. Eighth in eggs. 10th in red meat. Golestan's fruits and vegetables, especially kiwi, oranges, lemons, apples, bell peppers, and eggplants, have enormous potential in markets like Kazakhstan and Russia. Although Kazakhstan imports much of its produce from China and Pakistan, Golestan can compete in both quality and price. Overall, Golestan ranks as Iran's sixth largest agricultural producer and bordering the Eurasian Economic Union, has strong potential for enhanced trade and new free trade agreements.
When it comes to orchards, Golestan has a really strong position. We produce high quality fruit, both citrus and seasonal fruits like plums and peaches that are harvested in spring and summer. The climate is very suitable, and you can really taste that in the flavor and quality of the products. There's also serious potential on the processing side. These fruits are attractive for investors in areas like juice and concentrate production, drying facilities, and similar industries. The same goes for crops like potatoes, which are harvested here in spring and summer with very good quality. All of this makes agro-processing and food production a particularly appealing field for investment in the province.
The province is also one of Iran's leading centers for shrimp and caviar production. The Caspian Sea, home to five types of the sturgeon, produces nearly 90% of the world's caviar, and Golestan alone accounts for almost half of Iran's output. Its saline groundwater and government investment make it an ideal location for expanding caviar farms.
For many years, we've been producing sturgeon and caviar here, which is one of our strongest advantages in this sector. We also have the potential to expand fish farming in cages, which could open up major new opportunities. Because of our mountainous areas, aquaculture can develop both in marine environments and in inland fish farms. And with the Gorgon Gulf, we also have very good conditions for shrimp farming. So access to the sea doesn't just support our agriculture and fisheries production. It also gives us a strategic edge for trade, especially with countries in the CIS region.
Golestan is also the beating heart of Turkmen horse breeding. This famed breed, one of the world's fastest, thrives in the plains and deserts of the Turkmen steppe. Long-framed, powerful, and genetically distinct, the Turkmen horse is prized for racing and competitive riding. Every year, the Turkmen Horse Festival in Sufyan Village draws enthusiasts from across Iran and beyond. With the right investment and expertise, the equine industry could become another strong pillar of Golestan's economy. Golestan's wonders simply overflow any television screen. To truly understand this province, to feel its colors, its history, its culture, the best thing you can do is pack your bags and set out for a journey you won't forget. Come before the King of Seasons slips away.
Thank you for joining us on our journey to Gorgon, the capital of Golestan province. Please do tune in again same times next week to see what else is on. Until next time, take care.
You may cut off my breath, but never my faith, no, never my faith, it's my voice. Tame both my hands, but never my soul, no, never my soul, it's my voice. You may cut off my breath, but never my faith, no, never my faith, it's my voice. You may tame both my hands, but never my soul. My voice.
This is Iran Radio, and we have some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. Considered to be a verbal revelation by Allah, this is the actual word of Allah. The Quran is the holiest book for Muslims. Literally meaning the recitation, the Quran is widely regarded as the finest work in classical Arabic literature. Although the entire holy book plays a significant role in the daily rituals of its followers, the first surah, known as chapter Al-Fatiha, is the most recited of the Holy Quran. This chapter, which consists of 7 verses, is repeated in daily prayers of Muslims and on other occasions too. Now we listen to the translation of this holy chapter. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Praised be Allah, Lord of the two worlds, this world and the hereafter, the beneficent, the merciful, and master of the day of judgment. You alone we do worship, and from you alone we do seek assistance. Guide us to the right path, the path of those to whom you have granted blessings, those who are neither subject to your anger nor have gone astray. And now the continuation of the programs. You are listening to Iran Radio. Coming up in this hour, we begin with a spotlight. Afterwards, we return with another segment of radio production. Up next, Spotlight. Stay with us. There is much to explore.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. Now, the U.S. has ignited outrage after seizing a Venezuelan oil tanker in what Crocus has compared to Israel's pattern of unlawful military aggression and resource appropriation, denouncing the move as a blatant act of international piracy, sentiments echoed by a number of countries, including Russia and Iran. This all comes on the heels of nearly 90 people killed in U.S. attacks targeting over 24 small boats near Venezuelan waters that Washington claims are involved in the drug trade. And the legality of all this, this long list of one, the U.S. naval and military buildup in the Pacific and Caribbean near Venezuela over the past couple of months, two, the dozens of people killed in the absence of proof or due process, three, threats by the U.S. president alluding to ground operations into Caracas or his directive to CIA to increase operations in the country, four, Trump closing Venezuelan airspace, and now this highly illegal seizure of a Venezuelan oil tanker. Brings us the $64,000 question we'll put to our guests this evening on our Spotlight program, and that is, what is the U.S. and more specifically, the Trump administration's machinations for the sovereign and proud state of Venezuela? First, here's an update from our reporter, Gladys Quesada, joining us from Caracas. Gladys, good to check in with you. If you're safe and doing well, tell us the latest on the ground with these rising tensions and this seizure of this oil tanker now.
Hi, thanks for this opportunity to tell you what is going on here in Venezuela. First of all, as you were saying last night, the General Attorney of the United States, Pam Bondi, announced on Twitter, on X, I beg your pardon, that the U.S. Had seized this oil tanker that belongs to Venezuela, and she was saying that that those were coordinated actions by the government of the U.S. Afterwards, the President of the United States, Donald Trump, confirmed this announcement, and he said something that confirms one of the denouncers of Venezuela, and he said that they will take the oil and keep it. So that that argument is confirming the denounce by Venezuela before OPEC and other international bodies that the U.S. is trying to seize the Venezuelan assets and the Venezuelan resources regarding oil. And let's recall that Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world. Also, I have to say that this attack has other multiple resonances because, for example, not only Venezuela is denouncing this as an act of piracy and but also Russia has had a response regarding this, and also Cuba and other regional bloc as ALBA TCP. ALBA TCP has condemned these acts and has called for respect of international law and international diplomacy, and also it called for appealing to the legality of international relationships. Also, Cuba gave the total and full political support to Venezuela in this case of aggression and in this case of direct threat and attack against a Venezuelan oil tanker and rubber Venezuela as it all, because we know that since September, since August, Venezuela has been under this siege and under military threats by the U.S. And also, I want to be more detailed in the Russian response. First of all, because the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, had a conversation with President Maduro, as the government of Venezuela has been disclosing, and President Putin said that he gives full support to Venezuela. And also, Putin asked why the U.S. is doing this, why the U.S. is conducting this, and was demanding explanations for this kind of actions in international waters against a Venezuelan vessel. Also, the Chancellor Sergei Lavrov was saying that Venezuela has the full support of his government. And let's recall that Venezuela and Russia, not only they have a strategic alliance, they have also, in terms of defense, several memorandums of understanding, and they have been pledging, help and solidarity to each other during this kind of sanctions and attacks.
We do have a long program here. I want to cut you off, but thank you for that great reporting there out of Caracas, Gladys Quesada. And now for your guests. Joining us, Diego Sequeira, journalist and political analyst, also from the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. And Gloria La Riva, Latin American expert, joining us from San Francisco, California. Hello, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. Pleasure to have the both of you on. I guess we'll start there in Northern California with Ms. La Riva. Gloria, pleasure to have you on. Welcome. Your initial take, please, ma'am. You've seen the buildup, the military buildup. You've heard the rhetoric. You've seen the massacres. What does this all spell for you?
This is an absolute act of war, which took place yesterday. The piracy, the theft of the ship, and that was headed toward Cuba. But also, it's not only the beginning of the aggression, the enhanced aggression since August. It's really 26 years of the U.S. trying to overthrow, debilitate, create destabilization against the country of Venezuela for what it represents. Since Hugo Chavez's presidency of 1999, he has represented, and including President Maduro, the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela has expressed its right to share the wealth of its country with all the people of Venezuela, creating 5.5 million homes for the people, sharing the heating oil with the people of the U.S. previously. And now the U.S., unable to use sanctions, overthrow, attempted assassination, now feels that the only option they have is war. And we reject this completely. On Saturday last, over 60 cities of the United States saw protests of the people of the U.S. demanding no war on Venezuela, U.S. hands off Venezuela and its oil and its people.
Thank you, Ms. La Riva. Mr. Diego Sequeira, thank you for your patience. Diego, pleasure to have you on the program. Your opening thoughts as well, please. When you reflect on the past 4 months, U.S. Activity and rhetoric involving Venezuela, what is your assessment of the current state of affairs and the escalation we're seeing in tensions between the two?
Well, we have reached this point basically because all the other tactics of pressure, including especially the psychological ones, are just not succeeding. And you can see it with how daily life in Caracas is going, not only in Caracas, I've been on several places of the country in the last 2 weeks, and it's basically the same. People are far more focused, and this is something I've been saying a long time in several interviews. People are more focused on the holiday. People are more concerned now about the money, making ends meet for the festivities, and be able to, buy the presents for the kids and for the Christmas and New Year dinner and clothes. So this is actually the first topic of conversation you're going to find. And maybe the question of what the U.S. is going to do comes maybe a third, as a third question. So the thing is that they need, as it has been proven, and they rely strongly, not only, this is what the think tank documents show and other, and also several statements, they really rely on the fact that something needs to happen inside Venezuela in order to ease up the current clear regime change operation which has been going. This has not happened. So this is why they are stopping the notch a bit more and raising the volume higher as possible in order to see what kind of reaction this brings. Yesterday's raid of a Venezuelan tanker also shows, it's quite descriptive in several ways, but it shows precisely how this could be a very childish way to find some sort of reaction that would follow us, provoke some sort of, you know, casus belli of any kind in order to escalate quicker and to do the bid for the United States in that sense. And this has not been the case. So the escalation continues, but still the focus and the reliance, as we could see, because otherwise we would have seen some different maneuver like kinetic action, but this has not been the case. So they're really relying on what happens inside Venezuela, and they're really relying for us to do their bidding.
Thank you, Diego. And Gloria, I'm glad Diego mentioned the tanker, how he perceives what the seizure of the tanker was meant to convey. I want to get exactly your thoughts on this. This oil tanker seized, Venezuelan tanker, very unusual in that it was a merchant oil tanker seized by U.S. Naval authorities. What is it meant to convey? Is this some kind of threat, an act of intimidation, just blatant piracy? Trump says, jokingly, oh, we'll probably keep the oil. Okay, whatever. I mean, is that why the U.S. is down there in the first place? Is this a prelude that the U.S. wants Venezuelan oil? Because this is kind of out of step with what the Trump administration was doing up until now, supposedly down there for the illicit drug trade. And now with this oil tanker, it's a switching gears. How do you perceive it?
The announcement yesterday by Trump, sort of offhand comment, was meant to convey that the U.S. can do whatever it wants. Mm. President Trump can do whatever he wants in the most arrogant way. Oh, yes, I think we'll keep the ship, and there'll be more seizures. That's what an unnamed U.S. official said. Attorney General Pam Bondi yesterday declared that it had something to do with state terrorism. This is a complete lie. The U.S. has blocked and sanctioned very heavily Cuba, Iran, and North Korea, but in particular Iran and Cuba, declaring Cuba a state sponsor of terrorism in order to create this whole atmosphere of illegality, which in fact the U.S. is a terrorist in this action, in these blockades. And the fact that the ship was heading toward Cuba, we need to understand that it's also an attack and a threat on Cuba, which is really suffering great shortages in oil to run its thermoelectric plants, its energy. And this is what Rubio and Trump said in the first term, that we're going to bring down Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua. It's a very real threat. And yet what they're frustrated by is that the people of Venezuela, I appreciate Diego Sequeira's comments about the feelings of the people in Venezuela. He's on the ground. He knows what he's talking about. I think the mobilization of the militias is a message to the U.S. You are not going to have an easy way if you dare to attack our country. And that's why I think I, as an activist of the Answer Coalition and other groups, we believe that it's necessary for the people of the U.S., those of us who are in the country that's waging this war, we have to be active in the streets along with people around the world. And also the awarding of this war prize, it's not a peace prize in the Nobel Peace Prize. The rewarding to Corina Machado, to the one who is calling for U.S. invasion, begging the U.S. to invade, begging the U.S. to overthrow President Maduro, it has brought a lot of protests in Norway and other places as well. It's a sham. And we must bring out this hypocrisy. Trump just pardoned the ex-president Juan Orlando Hernandez for having brought in 400 tons of cocaine to the U.S. It's really about the oil that Venezuela possesses that belongs to the people. It's also the example that Venezuela provides to Latin America and really the world. What you can do when the people have its own resources for itself and for others in solidarity. This is dangerous to the United States because we're suffering the greatest economic crisis of the people of the U.S. where the wealth is being transferred to the billionaire class. Mm. We're suffering healthcare costs. We're suffering housing costs. And we're suffering joblessness. It's a war on the people at home. It's a war on the people abroad. And the example of Venezuela is important for us and why we must defend its right to its independence and its sovereignty.
Thank you, Gloria. And Diego, I want to come back to you. We've seen the U.S. president time and again condemn socialism and the socialist and left-leaning leaders and administrations in Central and South America. Is Donald Trump concerned, from your perspective, to export democracy to the Venezuelan people? And if not, then what is his dislike of Nicolas Maduro born of or based out of or based on?
You know, sometimes if you peruse the literature of his first term in office by persons like Mark Esper, the former Secretary of Defense, he basically tells a story about how Trump came to the conclusion that Maduro was the actual strong leader, Juan Guaido was, the wimpy-ish character here, and how he was basically conned by the Venezuelan opposition back then. So regardless of, yes, a clear, automatic, predictable, anti-communist, antique, and also Cold War relic in the ways that they address Venezuela, the problem is not only the example that Gloria just described, especially on sovereignty, independence, and resistance, it is also the living proof within the hemisphere of how even a very draconian sanctions regime that won't necessarily succeed in any of their principal aims, regardless of the harm that they have achieved in over a decade. So this is also part of the problem. Not only that, I mean, there's other reasons here. This is, yes, of course, it's about the oil, and yes, this, of course, is about regime-changing Venezuela as ASAP, as soon as possible, in order to further what actually is on the menu overall, which is a regional change, a hemispheric war, and pushing out, expelling the multipolar players within the region, within the Western Hemisphere. So it is clearly stated now in its current recently released national security strategy. I mean, even revamped in a very dumb way, I think, the Monroe Doctrine, and they just concede to Trump the Trump corollary and so on, in order to precisely prove that this is the doctrine. And everything that we've seen regarding the drugs and all the political or the criminal spins are not succeeding. And this brings then the need to try to shift the narrative as they are trying right now, because everybody sees through it.
And thank you, Diego. Let me put that same question. Ms. Lariva, we've seen different U.S. presidents and administrations concerned with getting democracy to the people of Afghanistan, of Iraq, of Iran. They time and again have said of Syria, of Lebanon. And now we hear U.S. President Donald Trump time and again speak also about how Venezuela needs to do away with the socialist leader and pave way for democracy. How concerned do you think this particular president is now with this age-old exporting democracy to Caracas?
The fact that the United States has financed Israel to murder what may be 100,000 people, half of them children and women, for the last 2 years, really exposes the lie when the U.S. talks about democracy. The word democracy is used to cover its real aim: geopolitical domination in the Middle East and now shifting to Latin America, but of course not giving up on its support for the genocide that Israel is carrying out. The world sees the hypocrisy, sees the lies, and it's time for us to strip away what this is really about. Trump says it himself in the Trump corollary that Diego mentioned, which basically says, literally, the resources of Latin America belong to us. Nobody can challenge that. It's the Monroe Doctrine on steroids. It's very, very serious. You know, it takes about 2 weeks for oil from the Middle East to reach the United States. It takes less than 20 hours to reach Houston, one of the main refinery sources. Citgo oil, which belongs to Venezuela, is right now on the chopping block, ready to be sold these very days. And it's theft that began several years ago, and of course began under President Obama when he declared in 2015 for Venezuela to be an extraordinary threat to United States security. This is part of what U.S. imperialism is about. It's never allowing any country, first of all, to be economic challenged, but it's also about the resources. Venezuela has 303 billion barrels of oil that it knows of right now. The next country is 267 billion barrels of Saudi Arabia. Venezuela has far more oil than anyone in the world. The United States has 55 billion barrels of oil in reserve, or known resources. That's a far cry from what Venezuela has. It's about oil. It's about example. Because of people who are homeless here, the middle class, which is suffering, having to pay mortgage of decades, if they knew what the resources used for the people of Venezuela are for, just to mention 5.5 million homes, they might start thinking, we need a change in this country, in the United States, and people are already thinking that.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. Diego, Senator Chris Van Hollen, a Democrat out of Maryland, said that this U.S. seizing the oil tanker has cast doubt over the administration's stated reason for the military buildup and the boat strikes. He says that this shows that their entire cover story, that this is about interdicting drugs, is a big lie, that this is just one more piece of evidence that is what it's really about is regime change by force. And my question to you, between Texas and Venezuela, there are a number of countries alleged to be involved in the cocaine, the heroin, the meth and fentanyl pipelines. So one has to ask, why skip all of these and go all the way down to Caracas if you're really after drugs? And if you're not, if you're after regime change, my ultimate question, because we don't have much time, I want to put this question to both of you, if we could, over the next couple of minutes. What would regime change look like in Caracas to you, Diego? Who wins, who loses, and what does this mean for the people of Venezuela, their stability, and their security moving forward?
Regardless of what the U.S. does, they have already lost. There's no possible direction other than rational dialogue, which is not on the table, in which they don't will receive significant blow, be it for a military attack of any nature, be it not doing anything and showing its internal weakness or the vulnerabilities that actually this kind of adventure has, and it's harmful for its own population. Hard to predict which one's going to be, but one thing is for sure in that sense, which is basically it hasn't and will not succeed because of blowback and because of the massive amount of blowback that this will ensue. Just think about it. A couple of months ago, because of the speculation of an attack, West Texas was surging dramatically. And this, of course, would have an impact on fuel prices inside the United States. So it shows how self-destructive actually this kind of operation is. So regardless of what it does, this it won't succeed, in spite of what happens to us, I might add.
And final thoughts with you, Ms. Lariva. Gloria, what does regime change spell for you in Caracas? Due to Venezuela as a nation, what does it do for the U.S. in the short and long term? And how do you see it impacting the dynamics of the neighborhood of Colombia, Brazil, Trinidad, Tobago, Guyana, and all the peripheral countries there in the area.
The ongoing legacy of the Bolivarian Republic that began with Hugo Chavez is not about one man. It's not about Hugo Chavez or Maduro. It is about a country of a people, despite the fact that there is a lot of polemical division between the people, those who are rich, those who feel that they gain by the U.S. coming in. But the masses of people who I have come to know over my 25 years of visiting Venezuela, being there on the ground, they're not going to give up what they've gained. And yet, the U.S. has not won a war in many decades, but they've caused mass destruction. Millions of people have died from Iraq to Libya to Yugoslavia, where I saw the NATO bombing while I was there, and it will be the same for Latin America. This is extremely dangerous for the whole region. The U.S. really wants to do away with the Cuban Revolution. And for them, it's a race for time. They want to do this during Trump's administration. They want to change the whole form of government of the U.S. to be one far more dictatorial, where the presidential power is in the hands of Trump. They're trying to do away with everything that we achieved in the 30s and the 60s of our social struggles. But what they want to do in Venezuela will be an utter disaster for the region, but I am confident that the Venezuelan people will be victorious in defending their homeland. And we need to convey that to our people, that we do not want a war. Peace, we must stop the war before it starts.
And thank you both for joining us in the program. Time has gotten the better of us. Appreciate having you both on. Our guest there, Diego Secrada, journalist and political analyst, joining us from Caracas, and also Gloria Lariva, Latin American expert, joining us out of San Francisco, California. And this brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Have you ever wondered where body organs such as kidneys, hearts, and eyes that are meant for transplantation are stored and what happens to them in the interim that they wait for a new home? In this episode, our story begins where technology becomes the guardian of human life, from the coldest temperatures to the warmest hopes, from small laboratories to grand national projects. Join us on a journey to the world of Danish Pajuhish Faj, where Iranian innovation speaks the language of life and saving lives, and a journey to the place where human organs are stored at 86 degrees below zero. Danish Pajuhish Faj Company is among the oldest and one of the pioneering companies in Iran that manufactures equipment for storing plasma, blood products, body organs, and tissues. It has been beating at the heart of Iran's biomedical industry for over two decades. Its name synonymous with trust and innovation.
Our company was founded in Tehran in 1995. The goal of establishing this company was to manufacture medical and laboratory equipment related to blood banks and the blood transfusion organization. We realized that the equipment used by the blood transfusion organization wasn't anything extraordinarily complex. This complex was being imported from abroad. In any case, we began designing, drafting plans, and carrying out the work. Given that I'm a mechanical design engineer myself, specializing in solid mechanics, we embarked on this project. Along with my brother, who had some information due to his involvement with the blood transfusion organization and was very curious about how these devices were built, we started this venture under these circumstances. We began from a small office in Tehran and approached the blood transfusion organization. At that time, we took our designs and ideas, built a small prototype, showed it to them, and they trusted us, entering into a contract with us. This effort has led us to where we are today. We are now proud to say that Danish Pajuhan Company has manufactured close to 20,000 units of various models of blood bank refrigerators for storing blood bags, platelet incubators, plasma storage freezers, and the A1 cell culture incubator, and a minus 80 degrees centigrade ultra-low temperature freezers for preserving tissues and bodily organs, which are present in most research centers across Iran. It is our honor that we have installation and commissioning representatives as well as service teams across Iran for this equipment, and we are actively working in this field. And most interestingly and importantly, some of the devices we first built nearly 27 or 28 years ago are still operational and used at certain centers. This is our pride, a source of happiness, and it gives us the strength to work with even greater determination. Currently, we are also producing research equipment, as I mentioned, such as the A1 cell culture incubator used for producing drugs like clotting factors and insulin. In pharmaceutical centers such as Daru Heshmi, for the first time in Iran, we manufactured and delivered our device to them, and it is being used. Other pharmaceutical centers also use our equipment, including our minus 80 degrees centigrade ultra-low temperature freezer. For the first time, and in response to the country's needs, we even designed it with two separate refrigeration cycles. Due to the servicing challenges in our country and the device's reliance on high technology, we innovated by using two independent systems for the first time. This ensures that if one cycle fails, the other continues to operate fully, preventing any damage to the valuable blood products or research materials. This is a distinct advantage over similar foreign devices. Of course, this approach is more costly for us, but given the operational conditions and our commitment to localization, it stands as a positive achievement for Danish Pajuhan Company and a source of pride for our work in this field. Furthermore, in the production of the cell culture device, it is worth noting that there are no more than three or four companies worldwide that manufacture this equipment. One of them is Danish Pajuhan Fetch Company. We are proud to have produced this device, and it is now being utilized in pharmaceutical centers.
What you just heard was just part of the long and challenging path of Danish Pajuhan Fetch Company, the path of turning an idea into a series of national and international achievements. The CEO clearly explained how the company managed to find its special place in Iran's biomedical industry through innovation and indigenous knowledge. But the important question is, what is plasma factor 8 and what is its significance?
Plasma, the golden yellow component of blood, is rich with vital proteins. Among these proteins, factor 8 plays a pivotal role in the blood clotting process. In its absence, puts hemophilia patients at risk of dangerous bleeding. The production cycle of factor 8 from plasma begins with collecting plasma from healthy donors. The samples undergo rigorous virological and safety screening to ensure their initial safety. Then, using advanced separation methods, the various plasma proteins are isolated. At this stage, factor 8 is extracted as cryoprecipitate and purified using modern chromatography technology. To make the product safe, viral inactivation processes are carried out, including nanofiltration and controlled heat treatment, which guarantee that the final medication is free from pathogens. In the end, the purified factor VIII is packaged as a lyophilized powder or a ready-to-use solution. Each vial with a specific dosage is prepared for injection into patients with hemophilia A.
In the research and development R&D unit of our company, we have strived to develop and manufacture equipment for the country under the banner of Danish Pejuhan Company to support the pharmaceutical sector and the storage of plasma and blood products nationwide. The device you see in the image is a blast device, a plasma freezer. It can reduce the temperature of plasma from approximately plus 50 degrees Celsius down to minus 50 degrees Celsius in under an hour, typically within 45 minutes. This unit features four shelves. Each shelf can hold six plasma units, totaling 24 units. Therefore, 24 plasma units can reach minus 50 degrees Celsius in less than 1 hour. Every component of this device has been planned and manufactured by the company's engineers. This includes the refrigeration systems, the electronic systems, and the embedded software programming. The data loggers you see in the image are also entirely built by Danish Pejuhan Company and Iranian engineers. As you can observe, all temperature data and device information are logged. You can extract graphs from it. Temperature graphs are displayed. It has a USB port for downloading data in formats like PDF and Excel, for viewing graphs, and also for monitoring device alarms. All device alarms are displayed in real time on the unit itself. This device is the Danish Pejuhan Company's minus 80 degrees Celsius freezer. This single-door freezer features a dual independent refrigeration system, two separate cooling circuits. It can bring the internal temperature down to minus 80 degrees Celsius. This device is used in research centers. In biological, biotechnological, and pharmaceutical fields. As you can also observe in this device, it has two independent cooling circuits visible in the image, along with a data logger that monitors the entire system. This system can log temperature data for up to 2 years and store up to 8,000 alarm events internally. Look here, it shows an error, for example, a sensor fault in a cooling circuit. These are tests conducted by our own team. We can see everything here, upper and lower temperature limits, and all other parameters. This also has a USB port for Excel output. This device is the plasma recover, which can lower the plasma temperature from positive 25 degrees, which is room temperature, to negative 25 degrees in a period of 3 hours. It has four completely independent chambers. This means you can place a plasma bag in each chamber. It is designed for plasma volumes from 150 to 200 milliliters and features four completely separate doors. The device you see in this image is the A1 cell culture incubator. It was used for producing factor VIII and the COVID-19 vaccine. During the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic in our country, when cases surged, they utilized this very device to manufacture the COVID-19 vaccine domestically. The device operates at 28 degrees Celsius. It features a rolling bottle system. It can culture drugs using the nutrient medium poured into the bottles. These bottles rotate, and at temperatures of 40 degrees Celsius and 24 degrees Celsius, bacteria are introduced into the bottles via filters, which aids in improving the cell culture process.
process in the factory consists of several units. There is a mechanical unit where the device's body is produced. We have the refrigeration unit, which designs and installs our cooling systems, and the electrical and electronics unit. Of course, before entering production, our design and engineering unit is highly active. It is comprised of university elites from our own country who worked hard here designing the product from scratch. They then hand over the designs to our production units. We have also done reverse engineering. There were devices that were reverse engineered, but we no longer rely on that method. For those devices, we did reverse engineer. We have fixed their flaws. Originally, American and European devices, they are now being produced to the highest standards for the Iranian Blood Transfusion Organization nationwide, as well as hospitals across the country. We have had significant achievements in the field of cell culture equipment. We have designed at least 5 distinct products in this area, from design to manufacturing, and they are now operational in various centers across the country. In our field, our annual production volume isn't very high because manufacturing our devices is complex. However, our factory is modern and well-equipped. The machinery and facilities we have are excellent. Similar factories we have seen in Europe and China were not superior to ours. But because these devices have specific complexities, our current annual production quantity is limited. The most important point is that the countries producing these devices have sanctioned us and refused to sell them to us. Yet, we have managed not only to design and produce these devices, but also to improve upon them. We can supply them to all centers in need across the country. This is a very positive point, and we are proud to be serving our nation in this capacity.
That's all for today. Another story of innovation and inspiration unfolded. Thank you. Be sure to tune in again for other interesting stories. Until next time, take care.